From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After writing the movie The Wrestler, about an over-the-hill wrestler trying to stay in the game, Robert Siegel has written and directed a new film about a sports fan called Big Fan. It stars comic Patton Oswalt in a dramatic role as an obsessed New York Giants fan who's a regular caller on the sports talk radio station where he's known as Paul from Staten Island. The rest of his life is dull. He's 35, still lives with and constantly quarrels with his mother, and works as a garage attendant. Siegel describes the film as about fan worship and unrequited love. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Siegel and Patton Oswalt. Also, Milo Miles reviews the remastered and re-released albums of the British punk band The Subhumans. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After editing the satirical news magazine The Onion and writing the screenplay for the film The Wrestler, my guest Robert Siegel has written and directed the new film Big Fan. It stars comic Patton Oswalt, who is also with us. Oswalt has a Comedy Central special premiering this weekend. He co-starred in the TV series The King of Queens, and in the animated film Ratatouille, he was the voice of the main character, Remy the Rat. Big Fan is Oswalt's first dramatic role. He plays Paul Offiero, who's a regular caller on his favorite sports talk radio station, where he's known as Paul from Staten Island. Outside of his obsession with the New York Giants, his life is drab. He's 35, but still lives with his mother. He has one friend. He works in a glass booth as a parking garage attendant. His insular world is disrupted when he spots on the street the player he most idolizes, Quantrell Bishop. Paul sees this as his big chance to show his hero how much he cares about the team, but as a result of a misunderstanding, Quantrell turns on him. Still, Paul remains a fan. In this scene, he calls into the sports show, occasionally reading from his carefully handwritten notes. It's late at night, and in the middle of the call, he's interrupted by his mother in the next room, who thinks he's wasting his time and his life.
Hey, Paul from Staten Island.
Hey,
what we got tonight?
Hey, what's up, dog? I gotta tell you, I am feeling good tonight because in a little less than 48 hours, we are gonna brutally shatter any flicker of hope the Cheesesteaks had going. We've been messing with them the last few weeks, letting them get back in it a little, making them think they had a chance of catching us, just so we can see the look on their faces when they come up short. Quantrell's back, baby, and he is good. Quantrell is back, baby, and he is ready to make up for some lost time against the Panthers. You better hope the scoreboard is broken down there in St. Louis because the Eagles are going to be so crushed when they look up at it and see the Giants-Panthers score, they're not even going to be able to play. It's not even going to come down to the head-to-head in Week 17. We're going to wrap up the East in a nice little bow this coming... Sorry. This coming weekend, after which we will follow our
predestiny to the Super Bowl as we ride the victory bus to the championship. And why are we riding in the victory bus
to a championship we haven't played? Because, as I said earlier, it is predestiny that we will take the Super Bowl this year while at the same time waving goodbye to the Eagles.
Thanks, Paul. Now that's a G-Men fan.
Oh,
thanks, buddy.
All right, okay. Thanks, sports dog. Thank you.
Robert Siegel, Patton Oswalt, welcome to Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, have you listened to a lot of sports talk radio, and did you ever call a station yourself, even as research for this movie, just to see?
Have I ever been a long-time listener, first-time caller?
Yes, exactly.
First-time caller, long-time
exactly.
Listener? No, I've purely, my experience has purely been voyeuristic. I've never called in. I grew up listening to sports radio. I still listen to it, but as a kid, I listened to it pretty obsessively every single night. When I went to bed, I would crawl under the covers and turn out the light and stay up way past my bedtime. And listening to WFAN, the air would fill with these voices of Murray from Flushing and Vinny from Rigo Park and Doors from Yonkers and whatnot. And I was this Jewish Long Island kid in my sort of middle class suburb, and I would hear these voices from sort of far off exotic corners of the New York City area that I'd never really been to. But I don't know, there was just something about listening in on these lives and that really captivated me, and you couldn't help but wonder what their lives were like.
What did you think of Patton Oswalt for the role of the fan?
Why did I think of him?
Yeah, I mean, he's best known as a comic and as an actor in comedies. This is not a comic film. It's not a comic performance.
No. I didn't do it in, sometimes comedians are cast in dramatic roles in ways that feel like stunt casting. Look at the funny clown. He's really sad inside. I just thought he was right. I just thought he really felt right for the role. He looked right. He was the right age.
What does looking right mean?
Yeah, what does looking right mean, Robert?
Can I let Patton take
it? No, you can't.
You know, I thought if he... we discussed it, and he said he was willing to bulk up for the role and stay out of the sun. He had a pretty healthy, glowing tan at the time, and he promised that he would go method and stay in his basement for a few months to kind of get rid of that.
Yeah, I laid off the mixed martial arts for about 9 months so, and really got doughy. So.
I thought if he would go through a you know, very advanced, aggressive anti-tanning process and then... you know, and then hit some Lucky Charms. we could get him into shape. No, I just thought, Patton, may I insult you?
Go right ahead.
Okay. I just thought he looked like he could be a an obsessive, you know, nerdy sports fan. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. Yeah, you know, and I also thought, honestly, on a practical level, you know, It was a very low budget movie, and I didn't think that Philip Seymour Hoffman or Paul Giamatti would be willing to. I'd be getting reamed out by their managers every night when they found out that I didn't supply them with a chair to sit in, things like that. So I knew I couldn't get you know those two guys.
And plus, Paul Giamatti is a triathlete. He wears that schlubby suit. That's a fake thing he puts on for his roles. Yeah, that guy has like, I think he's at 2% body fat right now. He's so cut. So he puts on this Paul Giamatti suit, and that's why he gets all this indie cred. And it drives me crazy.
Patton Oswalt, now that we know that you come cheap.
I come cheap?
Not
come
anymore. Cheap. We eat this.
Thanks for jumping in, Robert.
That will change now.
Yeah. Your performance is really terrific in the film. I mean, you really capture the kind of the loneliness and frustration and disconnection and kind of anger and niceness of this of this character. What did you think about the role when you were offered it? Did you say, yeah, that's perfect for me? Was that your first reaction or was it something else?
Well, when I read the script itself, I loved how it was written, that style of writing, which, because I'm such a film buff and love all those movies from the early 70s, those sort of difficult character studies. Do you know what I mean? Stuff like Fat City and King of Marvin Gardens, and I really miss that kind of writing and filmmaking. So there was this, I had mixed feelings, because on the one hand, this is a very dark, very, very messed up character, but as a guy who loves watching movies, this was the kind of movie that I'd always dreamed of being in at one point in my career. After a very short consideration, I had to say yes.
Are you a sports fan?
No, I absolutely have. Not only am I a sports fan, I'm not a sports fan to the detriment of the movie of a couple of the scenes in the movie when. Me and Kevin Corrigan, who plays my best friend, were supposed to riff about sports, and Robert found out very early on that we don't have any sports knowledge, so we would start improvising, and I mean, I'm not exaggerating, 5 seconds into it, we would both just stop because we had nothing. Well, that's the extent of our sports knowledge.
You would run out of sports terminology very quickly.
And then I would get scared, and I would make stuff up. It literally made no sense. Like, you think Broncos going to go 500 on the blue level? And cut, what? What did you say? It made no sense.
He knows the terms touchdown and ball.
Which I'm pretty sure are golfing terms.
You know, in the movie Big Fan, you know, Paul, the main character, Patton Oswalt's character, he works in a garage, but he defines himself by his love of football and of the Giants, but also he's Paul from Staten Island. He's the guy who calls into the station. This is who he is. He's Paul from Staten Island, the guy who calls in to the sports talk show. Mm-hmm. And when he calls in, he writes down on a yellow pad what he wants to say. Mm-hmm. And he either reads it or at least he refers to it during the call. And I thought that was so perfect, that this call, and he pretends like it's all being improvised, but this so defines who he is that he has to get it exactly right. I mean, it's his work. It's his, like, it's his thing.
He does it partially as a crutch, I think, because he's afraid he'll forget what he wants to say, or he'll think of some. You know, he's locked in this parking booth all day with nothing but his thoughts, and he thinks of all these great things to say, and I think he just has to write them down because he's afraid he's going to forget it. And then it's even more than that; it's his art. You know, it's this is what he was kind of meant to do. You know,
I almost see it in his own twisted way. He's a guy that his calling in at night is he's a musician with a day job. Where I have to work at a Denny's during the day, but at night I go out and rip it up. I'm an amazing guitarist. So in his mind, these calls are his performances that he has to prepare for, if you will.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people think that it's pathetic that he's so obsessive about sports. But the thing is, if he were at the level where he could turn that into being a sports writer or a sports caster or set up a really successful sports blog, it would be a passion that he could actually make a living at. You know, people always draw the lines. You know what I mean? They draw the line between the passion where you can't make a living and the passion where you can.
Yeah, but, you know, I've met a lot of, you know, because I'm very into comic books and a huge bookworm and film buff. So I've gone down to, like, the San Diego Comic-Con, and I have met versions of Paul Alfiero. I met a guy in this, he made his own Klingon costume, and he actually got every single detail perfect. And I was talking to him, and I said, "Wow, what do you do? Are you a costume designer?" And he said, "No, I do, risk assessment for an insurance company or something during the day." And I said, "Well, you could clearly be a costume designer on a show." And he looked at me, it had this look like, if I worked on the show, I wouldn't have time to watch the show that I like. It's almost like they don't want to follow their passion that far, because then I wouldn't have time to worship this thing. And also, I might not want to see that much behind the scenes. I want it to be this from on high, almost supernatural thing that I worship. So he gave me that look like, that's ridiculous. That's, I work during the day, and then this is what I do, and I never miss my show.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it, that what's required here is the ability to worship something at somewhat of a distance.
That's why I think that Paul is always sitting out in the parking lot watching on that little TV.
Let's describe what you mean. Goes to the stadium, but rather than buying a ticket, and I don't know if he can't afford it or it's sold out, but
it's just hard to get Giants tickets.
Yeah, so he watches it in the parking lot with a little TV plugged into the plugged into the car. Yeah.
But I mean, I was
giving
thinking,
advice to the team about what they should be doing, of course.
Exactly. yelling at a TV while he's inhaling fumes from his car.
Yeah.
But I almost feel like he's one of those acolytes, if you will, that it would be insulting to his team if he was part of the mass in the stadium just mindlessly yelling. He almost sees the people in the stadium as like, these are the Pharisees that just want to worship in public, and I want to go to the quiet place and commune with my God. It's almost like I'm better than all the riffraff in there. They're not true fans like me.
Like when you go to a Super Bowl party, you know, sometimes you can get vaguely annoyed that everybody, all these, women... people who normally don't watch football every week.
They're just there for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and they're jumping on the bandwagon one night a year.
How dare you?
And they're excited about the commercials, and it's sort of vaguely insulting, and you kind of want to just get away and watch alone in your room where you can really focus on, things that matter.
There's a couple of things in Big Fan that remind me of Scorsese films. As for Taxi Driver, in Taxi Driver, the De Niro character is kind of in the world but cut off from it because he's always in a cab. He's always in this like little coffin-like cab driving through the streets, disconnected from everything and looking at it through the taxi. And Paul, you know, Paul, the character in Big Fan, is in a booth and he sees all these people driving by, but he's enclosed in this glass booth. But it's also a lot like King of Comedy, where the De Niro character is sitting alone in his basement, living with his mother, and in his basement he has like cardboard cutout characters of the people he idolizes, like Liza Minnelli.
Right, he's got the wall with the laughing audience.
And he imagines he's talking to them on the set of The Tonight Show, and he has this really elaborate fantasy world with the people he idolizes, which is not unlike Paul's life idolizing his sports fans. Were you thinking of these movies?
I love both those movies, and I tried my hardest not to overtly rip them off. I'm very excited and happy that you're reminded of both of those.
Yeah.
Certainly are two. Scorsese is my favorite director, and those
mine too.
Two are is he?
He really is.
Oh, I didn't know. For me, pretty much from Mean Streets to King of Comedy is the greatest run any director's ever had.
Well, you know, you mentioned Taxi Driver, and you know, Taxi Driver, that movie can almost be watched in a loop because the very last image is of the empty rearview mirror, and that which is also the very first image. We just come full circle that this guy is going to ride around in this cab until the rage builds up, and he's going to explode again, and it's just going to happen in this endless cycle. And not to give anything away about Big Fan, but it struck me there's an image, there's a very specific image at the end when you talk about this guy is in a booth and then he communicates with the world by calling in on a telephone. And there's an image at the end that now he's actually gone even further into that world.
Oh, my God, I didn't realize that.
You know, yeah.
That was not
I figured that wasn't intentional,
no,
but
that's great.
His one, you'll see what I mean when you see the movie. There's an image at the end.
I didn't even realize I did
Yeah,
that.
Where even now his one friend is... has been relegated to the other world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
I hope somebody writes that.
Yeah. Someone better. I'll write it under a pseudonym somewhere.
Okay.
But I loved that aspect of and the one thing about Paul, comparing him again to Travis Bickle in his voiceovers does long to connect with the world. He says very specifically, I don't think you should spend your life in, what is it?
Morbid self-attention.
Morbid
self-attention. You should try to be a, what is it? You try to be a people
person
like other people.
A person like other people.
Other people.
Like other people.
And Paul, for all of his faults, and he has a lot of faults, he does not desire to reach out to anyone. He is actually non-judgmental in his
I don't think of him as being
isolation.
Complex and conflicted as
no,
he's
Travis
not a, Bickle.
He's not a yearning God's lonely man. He, if anything, his battle is to keep the world away from him. That's his heroic battle, is when the world sent its tendrils in to try to pull him out into the wider world, he's fighting them off.
If he could just be left alone, I think he would be happy. I think he's a happy guy.
My guests are Robert Siegel and Patton Oswalt. We'll talk more about Big Fan after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Robert Siegel and Patton Oswalt. Robert Siegel wrote the movie The Wrestler, and he wrote and directed the new movie Big Fan, which is about a really obsessive sports fan whose main interest in life is calling in to the sports talk radio station. And the role is played by Patton Oswalt,
who's
best known as a comic, but is also an actor. He was on King of Queens. He was the voice of the rat in Ratatouille, and he's got a comedy special coming up.
And if I may give the
yes.
log line of the movie, is that what they call it?
Yeah, log
one
line,
sentence.
Yeah. Yeah.
The way it will eventually be described in TV Guide magazine, with any luck. He obsessive sports fan gets beaten up by his favorite player is the hook of the movie.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how much to give away. So
you can give that away.
Let's
go
there.
Okay. That's the premise.
Yeah. So he gets beaten up by his favorite player. He, you were talking about how worshipful he is and how he wants to keep this all at a distance so he can worship it until he actually runs into his main object of worship. And then he follows him to a bar, a strip club. Basically.
Gentleman's
bar, yes. And then has to figure out, well, what does he do? So he offers to, like, he sends a drink over. Like, the guy's going to be really impressed with that. Like, he needs a fan to buy him a drink.
Right.
It's so kind of all wrong, his expectations. Like, he's so removed. But to not give too much away, the football player ends up beating up the fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the fan has to decide.
The bulk of the movie is how does he deal with the emotional fallout of the fact that the thing that he's built his whole life around has literally and figuratively punched him in the face.
Yeah, That's a good way to question. I mean, look, if you're a tormented Christian who's frustrated with the God who will not answer, be happy that he doesn't answer you, because this is what happens when the God you worship answers you sometimes.
There was that Onion story years ago.
Which you edited. Go ahead.
God finally, yes. I'm going to misquote it, but it was God finally answers prayers of, what was it? Answers prayers of little boy?
Something like that.
And then the subhead is no, says God.
The other one I love was God diagnosed as bipolar.
God diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Yeah, bipolar disorder. Wow, this guy's crazy.
Well, you know, another thing that this movie gets to is that the fan has a sense of we. It's our team. It's us. You know, even if you're alone in your room, there's this we that you're connecting to. But then, like, when the player beats you up, What does that do to the sense of weed? Can you maintain it anymore when you realize how insignificant you are to your hero?
That the thing in the original poster for the movie, it's now gone. But in the original poster, as I mocked it up, it had the movie had a subtitle. It was Big Fan, A Tale of Unrequited Love, which is kind of how I see the movie. You know, it's kind of what do you love? What happens when the thing you love most doesn't love you back?
Well, what I love most about that portion of the movie is that he is basically beaten into a coma, a very brief coma, and when he comes out of it, he's still the faith and worship is not gone at all. He has to then wrestle with it.
We'll talk more about Big Fan in the second half of the show with the writer and director Robert Siegel and the star Patton Oswalt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Subaru. With the safety and performance of all-wheel drive on every vehicle, love, it's what makes a Subaru. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, shooting a scene in a gentleman's club for the movie Big Fan. We continue our interview with actor and comic Patton Oswalt and writer-director Robert Siegel. Also, Milo Miles reviews the remastered and re-released albums of the British punk band The Subhumans. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and director Robert Siegel and comic and actor Patton Oswalt. Siegel is the former executive editor of The Onion, and he wrote the screenplay for The Wrestler. He wrote and directed the new film Big Fan, which stars Patton Oswalt as an obsessed football fan who's a regular caller on the sports talk radio station. That's where he shines. The rest of his life is drab. He's 35, lives with his mother, and works as a garage attendant. This is Patton Oswalt's first dramatic role. He's a comic and has a special premiering this weekend on Comedy Central. I want to play a scene from the film. And I think this is a really good scene in showing the main character's relationship with his mother. He's 35 years old, but, you know, he lives with his mother. In his bedroom, his bed, it has a bedspread that has the names of all the sports teams on it. I mean, that's the emotional level that he's still at. It's kind
of
like having a Star Wars, bedspread or something. But anyway, so his mother, he still has to respect a lot of his mother's rules about what to do in the house, and he feels very much under her thumb, but he doesn't know how to get out and be an independent person yet. So here they are, the mother and the son, driving home from Paul's nephew's birthday party. And at the party, his brother-in-law has offered him a job at Price Club, but he doesn't want to do that. He just wants to stay working in his garage, and he's really offended by the pressure of him to take another job. So here he is with his mother in the car driving home. And his mother is played by Marcia Jean Kurtz, and of course Paul is played by my guest Patton Oswalt.
What do you have against Price Club?
I'd rather not discuss my career.
You have a career? It's news to me. You could actually go somewhere at Price Club.
Yeah, like Dennis, please.
He's doing extremely well for himself. Who knows, he could probably meet somebody.
What does that mean?
Your brother and sister both found people at work.
Yeah, Gina was Jeff's secretary. He cheated on his wife with her.
She's a lot better for him than that louse Roberta.
He's a cheat. He f***ed her while he was still married.
Don't say that word in my car.
Which one, f*** or cheat?
You know. That language in my car.
Oh, so it's worse for me to say it than for him to do it.
Cut it out, Paul. You should only meet somebody as good as Gina.
Oh, boy, that'll be tough to top.
Yeah, for you?
Yeah, give me about an hour.
You have to actually date someone to top it.
I date?
Oh, sure. You're dating lots of girls.
You don't think I date?
I know exactly who you date. Your hand.
What did you just say?
Okay. So that was my guest Patton Oswalt with Marcia Jean Kurtz in a scene from Big Fan, which was written and directed by my guest Robert Siegel. Patton Oswalt, what did you tap into to get into this character's loneliness and frustration and sense of isolation?
As far as those were concerned, I kind of tapped into a lot of the, Robert talked about listening to a lot of sports radio. I listened to stuff like Art Bell and the best show on WFMU with Tom Sharpling, where they are these sort of fringe magnets where these people call in and they're so odd and weird, but clearly happy in their oddness that you realize that it only looks like loneliness from the outside. So I didn't play Paul as this yearning, lonely guy. I played him as a guy who, in his mind, he thinks it's all settled, it's perfect, and it's up to people that are watching him. I didn't judge him at all because the script didn't judge him. So as far as tapping into the loneliness, what I tried to tap into was, in his mind, his satisfaction with the circumstances of his life and his frustration with pointless exotic trivia and game facts and things like that, which I think that's what kind of brings out the sadness. And if you look at him, and also the scene that you just played and the other ones that I have with that actress who plays my mom, Marcia Jean Kurtz, she was so amazing. There's another scene where we really have a knockdown, drag out screaming match, and she was so amazing in those scenes that she was just so good at bringing out the frustration, and that there's almost an edge of fear in my voice in those scenes, because this is the one person that can get to me and maybe try to pull me out into the world, and I don't want it happening. So, and she was in stuff like Panic in Needle Park and Dog Day Afternoon, so she was there for a lot of that early 70s new Hollywood, and it's just so good at working with other actors that, those are the scenes I improvise the most.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, because she just constantly kept me off guard, because she was so, her readings were, she just chose to be so blunt and totally straightforward in those scenes.
In a way that mothers often feel privileged too.
Oh, totally. Yeah. There's no easing up to the hard revelation she's given me. It's just boom. You need a girlfriend. You need a better job. Your life is horrible. And I'm under attack all of a sudden.
Robert Siegel, you wrote in some details for the mother that I think are so perfect. Like, she saves all the duck sauce and soy sauce packets from Chinese takeout food in Ziploc bags. And she has, like, bags and bags and bags of them. I've seen that so much.
I had
much.
No idea how many people would relate to that.
Oh, I've seen so much of that.
Save those duck sauce packets.
Yeah, and then you have her. There's a phone answering tape that she has, like, for her answering machine. And it's so perfect. It's the kind of message left by someone who believes that no one has ever heard a voice message before, so they have
people
to be
of a certain age will still when they follow the rules. So
they have to lay out the rules in really clearly enunciated voice.
Please leave your name, number, and the time you called.
We are trying to bring out that there's some people who leave those messages as if no one's ever heard one before, and
they
don't know what to
do. That's the kind that scene required an answering machine outgoing message, and that's the way I imagine she would leave it.
The person who plays the sister-in-law in the movie, Seferina Fiore.
The great Serafina Fiore, making her acting debut.
Yeah. Now, she apparently worked at a gentleman's club when you were making The Wrestler,
she continues to advise you.
She still does.
Yeah, she's the manager of Headquarters, if I may slip in a plug, the finest gentleman's club in all of New York City, located on Manhattan's west side. That's Headquarters.
Bring your NPR card for discounts at for drinks.
Redeem your NPR funny money for complimentary drinks and lap dances.
NPR listeners, make sure to drop by Headquarters.
Just mention Terry Gross, and you'll receive an extended two-song dance for the price of one.
I got to stop you here. Have you guys had lap dances?
Our lives?
Yes.
In our lives or during the shoot?
In your lives.
I have had a lap dance in my life, yes.
Singular?
Singular.
I have too.
Yeah.
Was it for research or because you wanted it?
There was this period where all my friends were getting married, and it was like a spate o' bachelor parties, and we would, and people think that, like, the one thing they really got right in the movie about strip clubs is, usually in movies, they'll show strip clubs as you've got to approach the girls and the guys. The strippers tend to be kind of aggressive about giving you a lap dance because that's how they make money.
Yeah, yeah.
So they are very insistent of, hey, let's get a lap dance now. You're like, oh, sorry, okay. It's really, so that aggressiveness was very accurate.
Was there something you wanted to ask me about Serafina? I love her. I want to give her airtime.
Yeah, well, the reason why I asked about the lap dances is that it figures very prominently in The Wrestler and in Big Fan. So, so I was just
both of which
really
are part of my strip club trilogy. the third volume of which, that should probably be it.
I guess it won't surprise listeners to know I've never been to one of those clubs, but I always see them, like, in movies and, of course, on The Sopranos and other TV shows.
You've never
been
to a strip club, Terry?
Yeah,
Gross?
Big surprise, right? But they always look so creepy to me.
That was the hardest part of the movie for me, was during the beating scene. There's a shot where I had to have my face on the floor, so my face was pressed against the carpeting of a strip club.
Strip club carpeting?
So you tell, they show these outtakes of Jackie Chan getting his head popped open. I give him no sympathy. I had my face pressed to the carpeting of a strip club. I mean, I don't want to hear about these Werner Herzog actors who go through hell in the jungle. You know, put your face against the carpeting at Headquarters and get back to me.
Fitzcarraldo's got nothing on.
Yeah. I'll haul a ship up a mountain any day, as long as I don't got to put my face on a carpeting.
So you shot it in a real strip club, I take it?
Yeah, that was shot at Headquarters. Which is the club where Serafina Fiore, who plays the sister-in-law, where she is the manager.
And what is it also known for?
It's also the club where, coincidentally, Plexico Burress of the New York Giants was the night when he shot himself in the leg.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because there's nothing less dangerous than a gun in a pair of sweatpants. That's super secure. Yeah, put it in your sweatpants. You're good. Brilliant.
Excuse me for two things. I'm just going to go back to the lap dance thing. I just have one. I just have one more lap dance question for you.
What is it with you, Terry, with the lap dance?
Why don't you just go to a club and find out?
No, I see this all the time in movies and on TVs, and it just seems like it would be the most weird and, in a way, self-conscious experience to be a man having a lap dance. I mean, it just seems so odd.
I think it depends on the man, because a lot of guys, I think they get, it's that whole thing of, look, everyone's looking at me, and this hot girl is on my lap. For me, for the lap dance, who you're paying for.
Yeah.
Who I'm also openly paying for. For me, it has always been very, very creepy, because it's very aggressive. Like, I can't stress to you how aggressive the getting of the lap dance is. You don't have to do anything. They are, because that's how they make their money. And they're kind of insistent and almost, may I say, rude about it. So it's always given me the willies.
There are guys who find it creepy and awkward and depressing, and then there are guys who find it, there's a naked girl in my lap.
Right. I just feel it, because it's so public, I feel like an inbred Roman emperor. Like, look what they brought back from Gaul for me. Now dance, woman. You know,
it's Brazilian.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just so creepy.
Yeah, it's Croatian.
Yeah, exactly.
And Pat Oswalt, your character in the film, declines.
Well, yeah, because my true love is in the room.
He's just annoyed
right,
and distracted
is
by
is
a woman
player,
comes
yeah.
to sit on his lap, and he's just vaguely annoyed that she's kind of blocking his view of the football player.
Yeah, with her please get your gorgeous naked body out of my way so I can look at the giant guy that's about to
he's
pummel
kind of
me into
peering,
a coma.
There's a great shot of him kind of peering around the woman to try to see the football player.
I'm peering around a tan and perfect flank so that I can look at Quantrell Bishop.
My guests are Patton Oswalt, the star of the new film Big Fan, and Robert Siegel, who wrote and directed the film. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Robert Siegel, and he wrote, not the All Things Considered Robert Siegel, he wrote the movie The Wrestler and wrote and directed the new movie Big Fan, which stars my other guest, Patton Oswalt, who's an actor and comic. Patton Oswalt, you have a comedy special coming up.
I have a comedy special coming up this
on Comedy
Sunday,
Central.
Uh-huh. 23rd on Comedy Central, called My Weakness is Strong, and that is... 2 days later, the DVD and CD of that special come out. That's on Tuesday the 25th. My Weakness is Strong.
Tell us something about it.
It's my third album, and it's an hour of totally new material. And basically, I'm just talking about, whereas my first album was, I'm this young punk in the 40 watt yelling about the government, and then the second one, I'm getting a little older, and I'm about to get married, and I'm mellowing out a little bit, and then this one is I'm sort of on the way to becoming a dad. I'm not a dad yet. So now that I'm looking at them, it's these little snapshots of a guy getting a little older, mellowing a little bit, finding, better and better targets to be angry at. You know what I mean? So it for me at least, I hope that people find it funny. I hope they don't go, I want to watch the weft and wane of Patton Oswalt's life. I hope they just think that it's full of really funny jokes. But, It's the follow-up to my second album. I worked really hard in it, and I'm really, really happy with this. I mean, I'm so happy with the way that it came out.
So where are you now in your life?
Well, now I'm a dad, and I've discovered this amazing new drug called 3 hours sleep a night. I mean, I've done LSD and ecstasy, and those were amazing, but I did not know the kind of hallucinations and light tracers you could see on 3 hours sleep a night. It's like a constant rave. And also, not to get too soppy, but I'm watching a human being form from nothing. I mean, people don't understand, like, the first month, your baby is just a blank. They don't really, they're just getting... They don't even get the world at that point. They don't see that well. They don't hear that well. And then they slowly start. You see a person gelling. It's kind of fascinating.
Robert Siegel, you got your start professionally writing for and then editing the satirical news magazine, The Onion.
Yes.
You're not writing film comedies. Neither The Wrestler nor your new movie, Big Fan, is a comedy. Are you surprised that you've headed in a darker direction instead of comedy?
Not really. I see it as consistent. The Onion and The Wrestler and now Big Fan are all kind of on the same continuum. They're just on opposite ends of it. They're all blends of comedy and tragedy. It's just a matter of the ratio. The Onion, I would say, is maybe 90% comedy, 10% tragedy. And The Wrestler maybe is the reverse, 90% tragedy, 10% comedy. But everything I've done is kind of a mix of the two. I think The Onion has this is funny, but it's got this strong undercurrent of sadness. And I think Big Fan and The Wrestler are both sad with strong undercurrents of humor.
What's the best thing you learned about directing by watching Darren Aronofsky direct The Wrestler, which you wrote?
I would say not in directing, but in casting. The key to that whole movie is Mickey Rourke, and you put somebody else in that role, and it just is not the same movie. And he fought very, very hard, and the studio, it was a real uphill battle to cast Mickey Rourke in that movie. Nobody wanted to fund it with Mickey Rourke. He could have gotten three or four times the amount of money if he'd just stuck in, you know, a big, you know, one of, you know, any number of big stars, Nicolas Cage on down. But he really stuck to his guns, and he said this role has to be Mickey Rourke, and he was absolutely right. And you know, when I was casting Big Fan, I definitely took that to heart and said this has to be Patton Oswalt. He's just simply right for the role. Most roles I find in movies are not filled with the perfect person. They're filled with the biggest name who's not overtly wrong for the role, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you go to a casting director and they read your script and they give you a list of names for the lead role, they're not giving you the person who's perfect. They're giving you the person who is believable, you know, but is a big star. And won't outright ruin the movie because they're not right for the role. But by the same token, they're not the perfect person. And if you've written a character that you think has real specificity, you know, the list is very, very narrow in terms of who is truly right for that role, as opposed to who is kind of right for that role. You know, and it's amazing how quickly the list narrows down to a tiny handful of people when you're really thinking about it without, you know, star power considerations.
So do you get free tickets to any wrestling match you want to go to now?
I think Mickey does.
Of course.
That kind of trickle-down perk doesn't reach the screenwriter, unfortunately. But I think Mickey Rourke is now wrestling royalty. But no, I don't know. I don't know that I am.
Well, it's been really fun talking with you both about the new movie, Big Fan. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Robert Siegel wrote and directed the new film, Big Fan. Patton Oswalt stars in the film. It opens in New York and Philadelphia August 28th and later in other cities. Oswalt's comedy special, My Weakness is Strong, premieres on Comedy Central Sunday. The CD and DVD come out next week. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews remastered reissues by the 80s British punk band The Subhumans. This is Fresh Air.
The Subhumans are a political punk band from Britain who were first active in the 80s, but whose back catalog of 6 albums has now been remastered and released in the U.S. Although the musical setting has changed dramatically from those days, critic Milo Miles says the Subhumans sound more timeless than old hat.
Not all overlooked excellent music is a so-called lost gem. Sometimes they're hidden in plain sight. British punks The Subhumans were active from 1980 to 1985, and their records were never rarities, just very hard to find in the United States, where they never got much traction in their heyday. However, being vintage punks missed by the U.S. guarantees nothing. A U.K. group called The Addicts are by far the most long-lasting punk band with original members, and that's the most interesting thing about them. The Subhumans, on the other hand, will remind you why people were knocked out by punk in the first place. They deliver short, sharp shocks of fury and anguish. But like the best of the breed, they're angry in a funny way, or funny in an angry way, or something like that. As here when they explain why Mickey Mouse is dead.
Mickey Mouse is dead, got kicked in the head. Cause people got too serious, they planned out what they said. They couldn't take the fantasy, tried to accept reality. Analyze the laughs, cause pleasure comes in halves. The purity of comedy, they had to take it seriously. Change the words around, try to make it look profound. A comedian is on stage, it's taken for a wage. The critics think he's great, but the laughter turns to hate.
In their first releases, the Subhumans were an early example of British hardcore punk, a style that stripped the sound down to its basics in the manner of the Sex Pistols and the Ramones. The goal was to attract crusaders and purists, the only ones alive in a dead world of lies. The closest American parallel might be the group Minor Threat. The Subhuman shouter Dick Lucas, guitarist Bruce Treasure, bassist Grant Jackson, and a drummer known only as Trotsky hammered away at themes of mental disease, murder, oppression with every breath, and love as a disaster. But they also offered a welcome British perspective, with rants about class structure, work, money, and the evils of meat, in a song that ends with the perfect line, "It's the family butcher. Lock up your family." The Subhumans hit a peak in 1982 with their first LP, The Day the Country Died, which is full of clever snaps of melody, rhythm, and wit. Those who prefer the punk straight up should also check out the earlier Subhuman sides collected on the descriptively named EP-LP. The Subhumans themselves began to defy one of the commandments of hardcore punk. They evolved and became more elaborate. There were a few dead ends and blind alleys, but the Subhumans wound up their first incarnation with the 1985 album Worlds Apart, their most varied and reflective, including sighs about apathy and ex-teenage rebels. It ends with Power Games, a song by purists, all grown up to warn that purity itself is something to guard against. Subhumans have reunited a few times and are still semi-active today. Still, they did their best job of blowing down complacency as youths with brains on fire. In the 1990s, the roars of hardcore punk could sound dated. But by now, the commitment and conviction of the Subhumans sounds like a call to arms, waiting to be heard again.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed the Subhumans' back catalog, newly reissued on the Blurg label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. From Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year, and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, CityYear.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember TV producer Don Hewitt, the creator of 60 Minutes. He died of cancer Wednesday at the age of 86. Our TV critic David Bianculli will have an appreciation and will listen back to an interview with Hewitt. Join us for the next Fresh Air.